Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have Film Spotting's Top 5. The AV Club Scott Tobias will drop by for our countdown of the best and worst movies of the year so far.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, the triumphant return of Matty's Movie Minute, and music by Spoon.
But first, we have a first here on Film Spotting. It's a spoiler edition review of a film. We're bringing back The Dark Knight to discuss it here for another week, and we're very pleased to have on for this inaugural event Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Michael, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, gents.
Well, let's go ahead and dive right into this movie. And, of course, we really can't afford to have this discussion for a second time and spoil the movie, and we are going to spoil it. So if you haven't seen it yet, you maybe shouldn't listen to this segment.
Yeah, how exactly does that work on
radio
that we're encouraging people to actually
go
change
away
channels at this point?
But here's the thing. Here's my point. It made $160 million at the box office, so everybody who is listening right now saw the movie.
All right, fair
enough. The fact is, we're not going to spoil it for anybody. And I have tried, as I told you, I have tried to see this movie three different occasions now. I've tried to see it for a second time, and it's been sold out every time. So really, everyone is going to this film. But we're going to have some fun with this discussion.
I should tell you, I get calls at home from Fandango just telling me I don't need to try to see it because it won't work out.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's nice if they can give you those alerts. I need to sign up for that.
The Fandango alert.
Well, let's go ahead and start out with a voicemail. This is a little self-congratulatory. I'm patting myself on the back here, but let's hear this voicemail from a listener, David in Birmingham.
I saw The Dark Knight yesterday, and I listened to your review this morning. I really liked The Dark Knight a lot, and I was surprised when Adam said that there was a point halfway through the movie that it could have ended for him and had been a really great movie. I can't remember how Adam phrased it, but I did not understand that. I went back, though, today and saw it for a second time. And I know exactly now what Adam meant. Had it stopped when the Joker was sticking his head out the window of that cop car, and you see the Dark Knight standing in the rubble, had it ended there, it may have been an entirely different movie altogether, maybe even a better movie, who knows. But I do think that was a brilliant thought that Adam had. I completely agree. That may have just made it even better. Keep up the great work, guys. Thank you.
David there, as he said, didn't understand what I was saying back during our first review of this film, Matty, when I mentioned that I thought the movie could have stopped at about the hour 45-minute mark and would have been, for me, a masterpiece, but then it does keep going. He didn't understand that at first, but then saw it again
I want to give you grief, because the fact of the matter is, when Iron Man came out, and I had the temerity to suggest that Jon Favreau might have been a bit pedestrian in his direction,
sure.
I went out there and I said it.
Yeah.
Last week, you were Hedgy McHedge-Hedge.
Yes.
Because every 3 seconds, you were qualifying...
No.
Your problems with this film by saying, now, I just want everybody out there to know, we still like this film. We're still recommending this film.
It was every 30 seconds.
I see.
It was not.
Well, I'm so glad we're going to get a chance to talk about the last 45 minutes here, because I actually had problems with it as well, especially the transformation of Harvey Dent to Two-Face.
Right. And I do want to just respond to you briefly. Iron Man was a lesson in this. We both had criticisms of that film. And even though I really liked it and had a lot of things I praised about it, all anybody in our audience heard were the criticisms. Right. Everyone assumed I hated it. So maybe I was hedging a little bit during The Dark Knight.
Our interns are in therapy.
I know.
We're having to read those
I believe
emails.
It. Well, Michael, you actually wrote in your review of the film, your 4-star review of the film, then just when the film needs a good jolt, Dent undergoes a radical physical and psychological transformation and becomes literally two-faced. The transformation comes at a narrative cost. The film's focus is thrown slightly out of whack. I guess I felt like it was thrown more than slightly out of whack. Why didn't it bother you more?
Actually, I just have to recover from the beauty and the precision of that prose.
It was great.
To take 10 seconds. I think it's a real visual jolt when you see the transformation of Harvey Dent into Two-Face. I think that comes just when the film needs it. I do think that to devote the next reel or two... Do we still talk in reels in this digital age?
I don't know. Probably
not. In the next 20, 40 minutes or so, to so much of that character's transformation into a psychopathic vigilante.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Well, this is the spoiler edition, right?
Right,
we're saying it. There's no question it throws it out of whack, but somehow I thought the moment it happens at just the juncture in the story where you need something like that to happen. And I think one of the strengths of the picture is that all five, six of the major characters, without making too much of a hoo-ha about it, Nolan has really given the audience a reason to invest. You know, even with people I've taken for granted for years,
yeah.
Morgan Freeman
sure.
as Lucius Fox, Michael Caine as Alfred. We're not talking about actors who have the capability to even surprise a mass audience much anymore because
right.
they're so smooth and practiced. But to me, that two-faced transformation clicked into place very nicely. And then, I'd agree, Nolan drops the ball a little bit after that.
Mm-hmm.
Just I think it's a question of, it's not just a matter of saying, 2.5 hours, it's too much.
Right.
Because I think in the end, there's something about this film, messy as it is in some ways, there's something about this film that is satisfying to one hell of a lot of different kinds of audience members.
Right.
I mean, I've heard people come out of it feeling not beaten up, I think, in the way that I felt completely beaten up by a film like Wanted,
mm-hmm.
for example, but they feel kind of shaken up in a good
yeah.
way and like they've really seen something. And to me, yeah, God knows we're going to see plenty of Harvey Two-Face Dent in the next Batman picture, which has already been announced. So, it is one of the problems with the picture.
Okay, well,
I don't care. 4 stars. I'm
sure.
No,
I hear you.
Look, it took me long enough, guys, to figure out that 4 stars didn't have to mean perfect. Because I was so
stingy. We argue about this every
this.
Week. We argue about this every week because yeah. we do a 5-star rating. And for Maddie, he literally takes it like it's one of the 10 greatest films of all time in order to get
right.
a 5-star rating.
Right. Well, and
you know,
the world is full of hacks and geeks who are, every film is the best film of the year.
Right. Well,
know?
The Dark Knight, I want to say, on IMDb is now the greatest film of all time in terms of ratings.
Really?
So there you have it.
Did it dislodge The Shawshank Redemption?
Maybe
that
so.
Was up there
it was
for
there
a while.
For a while. Before we close that point, though, I do want to bring in one more listener comment, and then, Maddie, you can kind of respond to this. It's from our screenwriting buddy out in Hollywood, Brett Merriman, and he said, I totally bought Two-Face going after the crooked cops that ruined him. I had a problem with the end of the hospital scene with him and the Joker. Maybe I need to see it again. I think we all do. But I really didn't buy Two-Face going after Gordon and Batman. The script can say Dent was the best of us and say that his story is a tragedy, but I never felt any of that. I found myself asking, what is he doing? And that's death for a character. You needed a whole film to tell that transformation. Well, Brett's saying there exactly
yes.
what I could only allude to last week in the non-spoiler edition of this show. That's exactly what I felt. They sort of need us to have that scene with the Joker, with Heath Ledger, to somehow initiate this complete transformation into the psychopath. Hmm. And I didn't buy it, and I didn't see the tragedy in it because I didn't believe the transformation. He's been this white knight, the antithesis to Batman, the Dark Knight, throughout the entire film, nothing but integrity and trust and wanting to do the right thing. And then for him to turn on that, even after all that stuff that's happened, I didn't buy it. I would have loved to have seen this be the third film. Harvey Dent be the focus of that film, because even if we didn't see the transformation, we would have bought it. Think about if the movie ended with Harvey Dent being, his face destroyed mm-hmm. and his love of his life is dead and everything's gone to hell. And then you start the movie with him being Two-Face, we'd fill in all the blanks.
Maybe, although you certainly would get much more of that feeling like, okay, they're just setting it up for the third one.
Maybe so.
You
but
know?
I sort of feel like they were doing that already, even when they got
to the
end of this
film. Well, the problem is that his arc at the end feels so rushed. There's so much falling action going on in the last 45 minutes of this film. I felt so invested with Aaron Eckhart in that character as this sort of flawed white knight, if you will. And
mm-hmm.
the joy I got was the love triangle between Dawes and Wayne and Eckhart and his character there. And so to see it, how it plays out, it seemed to me so rushed. Again, I wanted it to breathe more because by the end, he's competing with time with all these other great characters who have these great storylines themselves. But he's competing for time with Zeus on the ferry, deciding whether or not to blow up the ferry, and,
right.
and which just seemed like another movie to me altogether. Like, all of a sudden, I'm in the Towering Inferno, and then all of a sudden, the Joker, for me, that character, was undone by all this needless monologuing. He didn't need to
Let me defend that ferry, the ferry sequence, which is, there's something wrong with the rhythm of it,
yeah.
a little bit off, and it's legato when it doesn't, it should be much more staccato, I think. But it gets at one of the things I really do like about The Dark Knight. I think the moral dilemma in that fairy sequence about, who's going to, in a way, the
Joker. Can we trust each
yes,
other?
Right.
Yeah.
And the Joker,
yeah.
in a way, the Joker set this up that he cannot lose, so, he's going to get a boat full of dead people out
right.
of it. And the resolution of that sequence is such that it really does play into the point of, you know, has Gotham City tipped too far into anarchy that it can't be saved? No, it doesn't. And I think even though the film has a considerable amount of violence in it, and a lot of it is sort of thrilling in a way that doesn't have any high-minded purpose to it, such as the sequence with the pencil and the disappearing pencil trick that we see at the beginning. The reason that scene is wonderful isn't that it's a guy ramming a pencil into a guy's skull, because, I mean, that kind of thing you can see in Shoot 'Em Up, Wanted, any lesser piece of crap, right? But it is staged so brilliantly.
It is.
And beautifully
it's
stylized.
Like that, and the way, and of course, Heath Ledger is finessing it beautifully, too. You can just tell Nolan is up to something. He's not going to pummel you with a certain kind of violence for 2.5 hours. And I think in the end, that ferry square off with the two boats, I think it gets at a good point. And even though the audience can kind of feel the movie straining and groaning a little bit there because there's a lot of cross-cutting between storylines, I think they're with it on an emotional level. So, yeah, the movie, it's a funny kind of picture because it's got this weird amount of narrative ambition to it. And yet I think people are responding to it.
Yeah, they obviously are. And I do like that ending, that big action finale there on an emotional level and on a thematic level, as you touched on. But just as cinema, it overwhelmed me. I didn't enjoy it, and I feel like he was trying to top what already should have been the big climactic showdown scene, which would have been beautiful, too, to end the movie on a note where Batman actually fails, where Gordon has to come save him.
Empire Strikes Back kind
exactly what I'm saying, kind of an Empire Strikes Back thing, where it ends there on that sort of down note. But how do you top the 18-wheeler, you know, down on Wacker Drive, flipping over and it not being sequence.
And that comes quite early. I mean, that's more in the midpoint, is it not?
Well, I felt like that was about the hour and a half, hour, 45-minute mark, where kind of what ends up being two-thirds of the movie. But I felt like that could have been a prelude to the penultimate kind of leading up to the end of the film. That's the big action sequence. And then you get to the end and you get all the 9/11 overtones. You get the big moral dilemma between Lucius and Bruce Wayne. And even, I have to say, when Morgan Freeman, even with all his gravitas, when he said, "Okay, I'll let you do it this one time," I almost laughed. It seemed comical to me. Like, does. I'm going to do something really wrong and that I find just totally morally reprehensible, but just this one time. Yeah. And that whole action sequence of the sensors and the radar, could you really tell what was going on at any point during that sequence? Did you have any sense of what Batman was actually doing?
I have a fair amount of that equipment at home, so I'm familiar with this the warrantless wiretapping equipment. But no, I do think there you are talking about a strained allusion to, you know, domestic surveillance issues under Bush, a lot of 9/11 stuff. It's not the film's most elegant, you know, writing. And I think Nolan honestly doesn't know how far to push it or really what to do with those allusions. Mm. On the other hand, I'm not sure I'd argue for a more explicit or heavy-handed use of that kind of thing.
No.
Because then it takes the movie into a maybe the wrong kind of contemporary comment. But, you know, look, you want one of these movies to have to have something on its mind, at least.
And, no, I agree.
And I think you could also argue the same issues with Iron Man. Just what is it really saying, ultimately, and is it effective in saying it about what we've come to in this world and what place would a superhero of a human scale actually have in this world?
Yeah.
You know, that might be the one thing that links those two very different pictures, Iron Man and The Dark Knight.
So. Well, and for me, it's not even so much thematically what they're dealing with. It really is just the way it's staged. It's the action of it. Mm. It felt very Michael Bay-ish to me in terms of the frenetic editing and really being more about chaos and kind of destruction. I mean, it tries to slow down when we get onto the ships and they're making the decisions. The rhythm of that, you know, again, kind of mixed with all the chaos of what's happening with the cops. And again, every time it cut to Batman seeing this view, this radar view, I had no idea where he was, where the people were. Mm-hmm. That was the stuff that when we talked last week, we talked about being exhilarated or being sort of exhausted by it. Those moments are what exhausted me about this movie.
Hmm. Yeah, because it's not the action sequences. I mean,
Early on,
the flipping of the semi, the lack of CGI in this film was just astounding to me. And I just love seeing that old style sort of filmmaking. You know, it just reminded me of
the bank heist at the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. I love that sort of grittiness of that. But for me, at the end, it just was too much. It was too rushed. And again, I felt abandoned by, you know, the Two-Face character. I wanted that. I wanted that to play out a little bit more. So.
Yeah, and I do wish it would be the next film. And I don't know all the
rumors
about
what's
going on.
But I will offer this. Anytime you can say Eric Roberts is an improvement over Tom Wilkinson, you're doing something right.
And you're right. And that actually is, for me, another little nitpick. And I know all the Frank Miller fans out there are going to write in and say you're insane, whatever. The mafia is part of Batman. But Christopher Nolan goes so far to try to make this movie relevant and current and modern. And am I just being naive, but the Mafia, really? I mean, I know part of the storyline is that the Joker has kind of made them irrelevant, but are they relevant enough to actually build a film around characters who the Mafia is a huge part of the city and stuff? Did you buy any of that?
Huge part. Again, it's not why I go to a movie like this, to see sort of the fascinating sort of cross currents with all these different criminal elements. I mean, in a way, you have an Asian businessman who exists in the story so that he can go to Hong Kong. And go get swooped up by Batman in a fabulously visual 5-minute sequence that really doesn't have anything to do with the story.
No.
You know, I'm not complaining because it was the best use the IMAX format of any of the 20 minutes I saw. But when you talk about the kind of Michael Bay action, the really heavy thumping quality or the heaviness of some of the picture, where I really detect it is in a film like Hancock, which to me, superhero picture that is just completely berserk in terms of stylization, unclear about what tone it wants to set.
That's a mess throughout.
Mess of it, and yet there too, and I'm honestly wrestling with this, and I'm sort of pleased to see that it's, you know, basically critic-proof, because I think increasingly we're only going to get more and more films that are critic-proof. But that's a picture that there's something about the storyline and Will Smith that people are just responding to.
They are.
And,
sounds like you and I had the exact same reaction to that film, and I think that we put that more on sort of a debate between the studio and the director, saying what, in terms of tonally, what are they going for?
Right.
The studio wanted one thing. To me, it sounded like the director wanted something else. Mm-hmm. Add Will Smith to the mix. In the end, there's something there amidst this sort of chaotic mess that made it watchable. And here, I think Batman succeeds much more.
Of course,
you know, leaps and bounds above that.
Here's what I don't get, guys. Okay, you get, you know, many different people who don't love The Dark Knight. Fine, you know, and it is far from perfect. It's not a neat and tidy kind of blockbuster, you know, even in the way that, say, like a really miserably written blockbuster like Titanic is actually a very kind of well-crafted scenario.
Sure.
You know, but you get a lot of people who really say that they find the tone of The Dark Knight sadistic, unpleasant, and really kind of punishing. And I know what they're getting at, and yet some of these people are the same folks that really went for a movie like Wanted, which to me was vile. You know, well made, but vile.
Sure.
And I don't need to pay $11 to feel like I'm messing around with my Xbox, killing a bunch of people. You know, that's not why I go out. But it sort of brings up the whole question about how you handle violence in a picture like this, and when does it strike a kind of real-world chord that works for the story and the picture, and when does it not, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right.
And I, you know, Wanted, no thank you. Hancock, not quite. Even a film like Get Smart, you know, which has no superheroes in it. But to me, that's shot. The action sequences are shot like a routine R-rated action thriller.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. You know, didn't help me laughing.
No, and I even said on the show, I mean, if I remember correctly, Steve Carell kills some Russian bad guys in that movie, and yet we're supposed to see him as this bumbling, nice guy and whatever, and it didn't work that all of a sudden he's waxing bad guys.
Is your family Russian, Adam?
Yes.
You have an issue with the Russians?
No, I don't.
This is the summer of the Russians, though, between Indy 4, the X-Files picture. It's like the Russians are coming.
We have not seen the X-Files yet, so we'll have to check
blow
it out.
Did you just blow the X-Files?
Is that the mystery?
There are Russians.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're out there.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, but I can't have you on and not have you address this issue. This is my big question for you and others of your ilk after the film, Michael, and that is, you subscribe to the theory a little bit that No Country for Old Men was an impeccably made film, but nevertheless pretty much a glorified serial killer movie.
Right.
Where we were all just kind of getting off on sugar, going around killing people, right?
Yeah, to some degree. Yeah.
To some degree. I mean, I'm simplifying it, I'm sure.
Yes, yes.
But at the end of this film, my question is, how is The Dark Knight any different?
Because of the parallel with the Joker character, in other words.
Exactly. And we even, unfortunately for Christopher Nolan, get the whole flipping the coin thing that we also get in No Country, not with the Joker, but still, it really was bad timing for him to have that.
And it's funny, even though I mentioned in the review this whole, you know, the live or die coin toss that Harvey Dent sent to every comic book geek in the universe. It's like, well, don't you have any idea that originates with the character for the Barbara?
The difference is that Anton Chigurh didn't have to explain his coin flip.
Right.
As it is here, you know, heads, you live. Tails, you die. We don't need that.
No.
You know.
But so what is the difference?
What's the difference? Okay, here, I think I find No Country for Old Men an impeccably made thriller that doesn't necessarily interest me personally, because I think the Coens, in the end, don't have anything to say about violence or man's inhumanity to man, other than
that's what the whole movie's about.
Other than its black comic possibilities.
Okay,
fine. That's still a noble effort, and you know, son of a gun. A few Oscars later, there you go. But why is that different from The Dark Knight? I find one of the great strengths of The Dark Knight to be the amount of screen time that Heath Ledger's Joker has. I mean, Jack Nicholson's Joker in the 1989
right.
Tim Burton Batman, he was in that picture almost half the time. And, you know, they were rewriting scenes during the shooting for Nicholson because they were really responding to what he was doing, thought he was funny. And Nicholson renegotiated his contract and ended up getting something like $60 million out of that film. So that, to me, that was more suspenseful how that contract was going to play out than the film itself. But I think the fact that Ledger has five or six scenes only, really five or six major scenes in the Dark Knight, it doesn't unbalance the picture. It doesn't, you know, you do in a sick way, you know, you cannot wait for the return of Heath Ledger's Joker.
Yes.
But I think you don't go into a comic book movie, a Batman franchise picture, with the same expectations as you do this sort of fancy, toned-up thriller with a title stolen from W.B. Yeats just to make it sound more important, you know. And I swear to God, if No Country for Old Men had a title like Crazy Guy with a Stun Gun, it wouldn't have won any Oscars.
No,
you know?
Because Bardem still would have been so much fun to watch. But
he's good, but there's nothing in there. I mean, look, it's fun in the way that Anthony Hopkins is fun to watch as Hannibal Lecter. Another film, right, I would argue, is got nothing to say about anything except well-done trash, Oscar-winning.
Well, obviously, when we had this discussion on the show when we did our end-of-the-year films, our favorite films of last year, that I saw more thematically going on in that film. But you
That's
actually
incorrect.
Said
That's
it.
Incorrect, though.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But I said it nevertheless.
Interesting reading, incorrect.
But with this movie, you said it. There is a sadistic thrill you get every time the Joker comes on screen in this movie. Isn't that exactly what all of the No Country for Old Men detractors said was wrong with that film? Is that we were all enjoying too much the violence of it, and the Coen brothers were kind of tapping into this 9/11, you know, cynicism and horror, and we were enjoying the violence way too much. I would say that Bardem goes about his work totally dispassionately.
Mm-hmm.
It's what he does. It's what he is. It's a job. Heath Ledger's Joker, I mean, we see him as amusing. He's fascinating. He's a really intriguing, riveting character. I think Nolan should be the one getting charged with that same crime.
Not for me. For me, I think you could say that about the picture if each of the Joker's scenes tried to top the previous one in terms of the lurid method of the slaughter or the, you know, the hand-to-hand killing, whatever. You do get one or two scenes like that. I also happen to think that thing with the pencil, the beginning, is so brilliantly timed and staged and acted, it transcends every other attempt to get a sick laugh out of that kind of killing that I've seen in the last couple of years on screen. So,
well, hopefully Michael Haneke will call in and weigh in on this subject.
I hope
because I'm sure he's boycotting both films.
Good point.
None of it is amusing. None of it.
Well, as much as I would love to continue this discussion for another segment or two, it is time to conclude. Michael, again, it was really great to have you on and get your insights and just shed some light on your reaction to this film. It's always fun to have you on.
Adam, Maddie, thank you.
It's time for a quick break. And, of course, if you do have some more Dark Knight feedback for us, we've already received a ton of it. You can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 206-203-2463.
I'm afraid insanity is like gravity. All it took for you guys to lose your minds was a little push. Listener feedback is next. Stay with us. Came made it where the most never been. Fixed up outside and broke within. She always said goodnight, knowing the wrong from right. But on the way the time, they showed her things she never thought. And left her down in the dumps. Whoa. All day and all of the light. Don't let it get you down. Don't let it get you down. Don't let it get you down.
Hi, this is Jason Eakin from Kansas City. I'm sure you're getting a lot of emails about, or voicemails about Dark Knight. I would like to point out that in the last 12 months, we have been given three performances by Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, and now I would put on par with that Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight as three amazing depictions of evil and madness.
Adam, Maddie, this is Nizar from Tampa, Florida. I have to say, yes, it completely lived up to my expectations. Starting the summer off, Dark Knight was completely my most anticipated movie of the year, actually. And I think it delivered on all levels. It was the directing. It was the cinematography. I mean, everybody brought their A game on this film. The acting was phenomenal. I mean, least of all, we can say that, yes, Heath Ledger's performance was incredible, but really everybody did a great job.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Matty Robinson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We do want to thank Michael Phillips one more time for stopping by. Of course, Michael from the Chicago Tribune, and at least for a little while longer on At the Movies. I know that's why I tune in every week to see him. It's always fun to have him on. He was great.
So nice of him to come wearing a Film Spotting t-shirt.
Yeah, it was. How about that? I didn't even send that to him. He just bought that himself. A couple of voicemails we heard there coming out of the break on The Dark Knight, and we will get into much more of your Dark Knight feedback on next week's show. We're going to make that the blowout Dark Knight edition of listener feedback. We want to go ahead and let you guys digest everything we've discussed here the past 2 weeks on the show, hopefully giving you some things to chew on. Let's get to our poll questions, though, right now, Maddie. Starting with our results from last week, we asked you which summer comedy you're most excited to see. We got four choices here that we're both very excited about: Hamlet 2, Pineapple Express, Step Brothers, which opens this weekend, and Tropic Thunder. Maddie, how did it come out?
Number one at 46%, Pineapple Express. In second place, Tropic Thunder, 35%. And Hamlet 2, only 13%. Surprised me a little bit there. Step Brothers, Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly, only 6%. I think people burned out a little bit.
Well, when you go with Semi-Pro and Blades of Glory, it's been a little bit bleak lately for Will Ferrell, but I am curious to see Step Brothers, and I'm curious to see all those movies. Pineapple Express, I'm not surprised it finished top place there because, of course, we have a bunch of stoners in our audience. I mean, that's just obvious from their feedback every week, so not a big shock there. But this week's poll question, of course, tying in with this week's show, we're sharing our top five movies of the year so far. We want to know what you think the best movie of the year so far is.
Is it The Dark Knight, In Bruges, Iron Man, WALL-E, or Other?
So, of course, we looked at Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes and thought about the movies we've reviewed here and reviewed favorably. And really, The Dark Knight, Iron Man, WALL-E really stand out among the best reviews.
Excuse me, no 10,000 BC?
And adored. No 10,000 BC, though.
No Untraceable?
I have a feeling we may hear about one of those movies later in the show in one of the segments. But In Bruges, of course, a movie we had a lot of love for last week on the show. Me, you, Steve Procopi from Ain't It Cool News, we talked about the great performances in that movie, and I know it's a movie that we both like quite a bit, so we wanted to include that one in there as well. I do think one of those four is going to win this one hands down, but of course we're going to leave the other in there just in case, and we're not going to really share right now our pick here. We'll go ahead and wait and see what happens as we get into our top fives later in the show, but you can make your voice heard at filmspotting.net.
Maddie's Movie Minute. He takes us to the show for 60 seconds or so and gets right to the point of what we need to know.
And now,
here's Maddie.
So I go on a couple dates this weekend. Same girl, very nice. On her suggestion, we go to Blue Man Group on Sunday. Hey, I've got nothing against PVC pipe. Good times were had, smiles all around. So I decide, you know, let her into my world a little bit. So we go see Step Brothers on Monday night. I'm laughing, not uproariously. The movie is basically a compilation of scenes strung together, giving an excuse for two comedians to improvise and riff off of each other. No story to speak of. The R rating basically affords John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell the annoying ability to use the F word, so much so that it becomes their out pitch in nearly every scene, basically becoming a comic crutch. But the movie is funny, a step above Semi-Pro and Walk Hard in terms of guffaws induced, and Dick Jenkins is great in the supporting role. To my right, however, my date, total utter silence throughout the entire movie, maybe one chuckle. So I ask her after the movie what she thought, and she gave me one of those, "Oh, it was fun." The same kind of forced, uncomfortable answer you don't want to hear when asking your girlfriend if she thinks of other guys.
Maddie's Movie Minute. Maddie's Movie Minute. Quick reviews to help you choose it. Maddie's Movie Minute.
Well, I'm not sure what quite to make of that, Maddie. I feel sorry for you. I guess I wonder, even if she was interested, would you want to go out with someone again who couldn't see the comedic genius of a Will Ferrell and a John C. Reilly together?
Yes, I would have absolutely no problem with that whatsoever.
All
because
right.
Because I am a modern man, Mr. Kempinar.
And by modern, you mean desperate.
Marty from Lincoln, Rhode Island writes in on the top five performances of the year so far. The fact that Charlie Bartlett is the worst movie of last year, tied with The Happening, should automatically disqualify it from the top of any top five list. Robert Downey Jr. is one of my favorite actors, but that movie was unbearable. On top of that, it is ridiculous that you two refuse to recognize Heath Ledger's performance as Joker as the best performance of the year. He deserves every Oscar, even best adapted screenplay, until someone tops that performance, which won't be anytime soon. Don't be too proud to love a great movie slash performance when you see one. I'm afraid insanity is like gravity. All it took for you guys to lose your minds was a little push.
Well, Maddie, you maybe have to step up here and defend yourself, since you just had him as an honorable mention. I did at least have Heath Ledger in my top five, though just at number four. So what say you in response to Martin from Rhode Island?
Well, I would suggest Martin from Rhode Island go out and check out the other performances on my list and see what you think.
Yeah, maybe Heath Ledger is great, and he is. I think we both agree with that. We said as much last week on the show, but maybe there are, in fact, better performances. Worth checking out some of those films if you haven't seen them already. Neil from Northern Illinois writes in, just saw Forgetting Sarah Marshall. I know he wasn't given all that much to do, but I thought, as far as comedic roles go, Russell Brand was great in it. Probably the funniest aspect of the film, for me at least.
Oh, we commented on this when we actually reviewed that film. We thought Russell Brand was great
because
he broke the mold. There was such an opportunity for him just to be this caricature, just to be this jerk. And it's punctuated with these just beautiful moments where you're kind of in awe of the guy. Yeah. You're thinking,
he is cool.
Right.
And of course, that is the Russell Brand performance. But I'm sorry, all you Judd Apatow detractors out there, and we know you are out there. But that's also the writing. That's because Judd Apatow doesn't write characters who are caricatures. There is some depth to them, as we saw with many of the characters in that film. So a great choice there by Neil.
Well, David Howald from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, wants to give you some props. Adam, he says, thanks so much for giving Saleh Bakri some love for the film The Band's Visit. His performance as Khalid is so nuanced and at times so touching that sometimes you forget his ridiculous playboy moves. Singing My Funny Valentine to a random teller at the bus station was one of the funniest individual moments of last year. Thanks for giving a movie that got snubbed on an Oscar, technicality, some love.
Yeah, it really is a good performance. And of course, as I mentioned last week on the show, I forgot to include his name. I did include it in the show notes. And I'm really glad that David wrote in to give Saleh Bakri some more love, because it really is a fantastic performance. And a movie, Maddie, I know you definitely want to check out. Let's get into some more of our feedback here on our top five creatures. We started this feedback last week on the show in connection with our review of Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy 2. And we start with this one from Sean Lane right here in Chicago. His number five, The Zombies from 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later. To pick one, I'll go with Robert Carlyle in the second film. An undead Begbie is truly scary. Number four, The Alien from Cloverfield. I like this film so much more than I thought I would, and the monster was the major reason why. Number three, Frankenstein's Monster. Neither of you thought to include the granddaddy of them all. Number two, Pinhead. Yes, the film sucked. Yes, the acting was atrocious, but Pinhead rocked. I will not argue this. And finally, the only movie creature on any of our lists that gave me nightmares. His number one choice here from Sean in Chicago, a dramatization. Crown Point, Indiana, circa 1968. I'll be playing the role of Sean's mom.
And action.
Hey, Sean, put your coloring book down and watch The Wizard of Oz with Mommy.
Okay, Mommy. Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road. Oh, a talking scarecrow. That lion is a scaredy cat. That was my first ever joke. The witch is kind of scary, Mommy. What are those things? What are those things? Are those real? Will they come into my room at night?
Yes, they will come into your room at night, little Sean. The Wicked Witch's Flying Monkeys. My top five movie creatures of all time. They still creep me out. And Sean, you are not alone, as another Sean chimed in.
If you're going to make a top five movie creatures, you cannot make that list without adding the most disturbing member of this phylum, the flying monkeys in The Wizard of Oz. If Medusa from Crash of the Titans frightened you, what in the world did these biological abominations do to you?
Yeah, Sean from Westland, Oregon there. And I wanted to briefly mention that we got an email a while back from Paul in Windsor, Ontario, just recently actually, where he recommended this book called 10 Bad Dates with De Niro. And the book is a lot like film spotting. It's a bunch of top 10 lists, some really inspired stuff where they get all these different film writers and people to share their top 10 lists. And one of the categories is like movies that traumatized you as a kid. And the number one choice for that particular writer was The Monkees from The Wizard of Oz. So apparently there are a lot of people out there, just like the two Seans here, who were traumatized by The Wizard of Oz. I don't know. I saw it when I was a kid. We watched it every year. The monkeys never scared me, and I got scared easily as a kid.
Yeah, the wizard scared me.
Really?
When the Cowardly Lion is running down, you know, long hallway. Yeah, that freaked me out. But yeah, the monkeys, they never got to me.
No, me neither. Okay, well, let's close with this one from Ned Meyer in Rochester Hills, Michigan. His number 5, The Monster from The Host. A great update of Godzilla. The movie was campy, but so entertaining. It had the heart that most science fiction or horror movies lack these days. Plus, the monster was vicious.
I can't agree with that pick. I really just did not like that monster at all.
Yeah, I didn't mind the movie. I didn't mind the monster. I thought he had a little bit of personality. I can see it maybe as a number 5, but no higher. Number 4 for Ned, the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, of course, was on our list, our number 2 picks. Number 3, The Beast from Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, one of my favorite movies of all time. His smoking hands, or paws, his devotion to Belle, and the playful way he drank from the pond, brilliant. Number 2, Oogie Boogie from Nightmare Before Christmas, and Ned's number 1 choice, and this is a great one, No Face from Spirited Away. There are so many great creatures in this beautiful movie. No Face is my personal favorite. Of course, the great Miyazaki film was part of our animation marathon here on Film Spotting a while back, and I have to say, another pick here, this happens from time to time on the show. I completely forgot about Spirited Away. I actually think No Face would have cracked my top 5, Maddie.
Well, I had an unwritten rule which absolves me from blame here. No two-dimensional characters, so, you know, no Pinocchio, no Scarlett Johansson, any of that.
All of a sudden, rules matter to you, the guy who included the T-1000.
This is not Nom. Host discretion.
Yeah, host discretion, exactly. Well, as always, thanks for all the great feedback. Please email any other comments or suggestions to feedback@filmspotting.net. Next week, we will dive into all of your Dark Knight feedback.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater and the AV Club. Scott Tobias joins us for our top 5 films of the year so far. We'll even mix in 3 of the year's worst. I'm looking at you, Sean.
Sun on your skull, back to the light. Go pack your bags, take up the sight, 'cause this world wasn't meant for us both. Who made the night? Who made the day? Who gave you life? Who gave you say? I said, this world wasn't meant for us both.
Mr. Angier, have you considered the cost of such a machine?
Price is not an object.
Perhaps not, but have you considered the cost?
I'm not sure I follow.
Go home. Forget this thing. I can recognize an obsession. No good will come of it.
Well, hasn't good come of your obsessions?
At first, but I followed them too long. I am their slave. And one day they will choose to destroy me.
If you understand an obsession, then you know you won't change my mind.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. Time now for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I absolutely massacre, destroy, obliterate, leave for dead a beloved screenplay. And you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved or not so beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard between David Bowie and Hugh Jackman from Christopher Nolan's The Prestige. Of course, a tie-in with our discussion of The Dark Knight, also helmed by Nolan and starring Mr. Christian Bale.
I suppose it would have made more sense to have a scene that had Christian Bale in it, but nevertheless, that was the scene we went with because we liked it. And Cornell Chang in San Mateo, California, wrote in asking, was Maddie still channeling David Bowie playing Hugh Jackman's role? Yes, exactly.
Yes, of course I was. I was so excited that the whole reason we did that scene was because we were going to do Tesla as Bowie, and you came in having worked on your Bowie all week. Took my thunder. I couldn't let that happen.
Yeah, and there are a lot of listeners out there right now scratching their head going, Adam worked on that Bowie? It's kind of hard to believe, but I did. Ben Black in Tulsa also wrote in and said that he thought, Maddie, you were doing Bowie by way of William Shatner. A couple people mentioned William Shatner, so what went wrong there in the impression?
Well, I can assure you that Ben Black from Tulsa, Oklahoma ain't winning this week, so why don't you reach into that Film Spotting hat and pull out this week's winner?
And the winner is Stephen Aparicio from La Puente, California.
I think it's just down the road from Chino.
Congratulations, Stephen. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Monty used to act.
Well, I hardly say that. It's true I crept the boards in my youth, but I never really had it in my blood, and that's what's so essential, isn't it? Theatrical zeal and veins.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it ties in with our top five topic this week, best movies of the year so far, though I guess all we'll say by way of a hint is sort of indirectly. There isn't necessarily a clear connection, but astute film spotting listeners.
This is kind of a tricky one.
We'll pick it out. This is a tricky one here. So let's go ahead and get started. And actually, you started off, Maddie. I'm going to give you the action. And action.
So tell me about yourself. You married?
Divorced. Two kids.
What do you do for fun?
I love to read. I enjoy books.
Yeah, those are the same things. Why have you been going through my trash? I'll come back to that. How did you know he was going to blank?
I just guessed.
Just guessed.
The first one seemed too easy.
All right, this can no longer be ignored. What is that you're drinking?
It's an Aqua Velva. You wouldn't make fun of it if you tried it. And scene.
Oh, my God.
Of course, we did have to change a notable line there that would have made it way too easy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
What, did I have the doe-eyed look, the blank stare going?
I think you brought more depth and resonance to that role than that actor ever could.
Maybe so. Well, now that we've given you a big hint, let us know what movie we just massacred. Email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, July 30th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
Falling slowly, eyes that know me.
I'm Canadian.
Oh, that's
from
cool.
Vancouver. I live here illegally, actually. Don't tell anyone. But it works out in my advantage, I think, ultimately, because I don't have to pay any taxes.
You know.
How do you know? What do I always say? Anyone can cook.
Well, yeah, anyone can. That doesn't mean that anyone should.
Is it my scar?
Car.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
It's top five time here on the show. We're sharing our top five movies of the year so far, and you heard there a brief montage of some of the films that appeared on last year's edition of this show, our favorite movies that time. We had our same guest on here at this point. We welcome him back to the show from the AV Club. You can, of course, check it out at avclub.com. Scott Tobias, thanks for coming on, Scott.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
It is always great to have you on the show. And you were here, as I said, last July when we did this, actually along with our first guest here this week on the show, Michael Phillips. And some of the movies you heard there in the montage once appeared on all three of our lists. Mm-hmm. Death Proof was on your top five and on my end of the year top 10. Knocked Up made all three of our top five lists. And actually, I threw in Ratatouille there just for Michael Phillips because he was so enamored with that movie. But we want to get into this year's list, the movies that really stood out so far this year. Scott, what's your number five?
Okay, I'm going to preface this by saying that The Dark Knight would probably be on this list if I were to see it a second time.
Okay, we're all in that same boat.
Right, because we saw it under poor conditions. The sound was not where it
That's
should
true.
Be, and I didn't feel like I could wrap my head around it. So with that caveat out of the way, my number five film is Funny Games, mm-hmm. the critically beloved Funny Games. And I feel like this is the only safe place left to talk about this movie.
It's true.
Because the two of you actually had some appreciation for it as well. This is Michael Haneke's shot-for-shot remake of his Austrian home invasion thriller from a decade ago. And it has to be one of the most perverse undertakings in recent memory. You know, the original film agitated quite a few critics at the time, and those same critics were equally agitated when he made the same movie again. But he sort of rebottles the magic that was in that original film. He knows, as a director, just how to suck the oxygen right out of the room. I mean, before you even get to his messages about film violence, I think you have to acknowledge just how strong the execution of this movie mm-hmm. is. And I think the issues he raises are worth thinking about.
Yes.
It's worth thinking about our relationship to violence that in movies. It's 99% of movies don't make us think that way.
Right.
Why can't one movie do that in a provocative way? And I think this movie accomplishes that.
Okay, well, we're going to bite our tongues here for a minute because it just might come up on one or both of our lists. Maddie, your number five.
No, my number five is Bigger, Stronger, Faster, the documentary. I highly recommend this film just because it's such a personal journey for the protagonist. And if I can recommend a documentary just for the most simplistic of reasons, it's because I learned so much from this film.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that helps you cut down on ignorant jingoism is good for America, and I would highly, highly recommend people see this film.
Yeah, actually, I'll go ahead and say at this point, it's on my honorable mentions. I hadn't seen that movie, the documentary about steroids, when you reviewed it on Maddie's Movie Minute, but I have now since seen it, and I was a big fan of it, so a great pick there by you. I do want to mention some regrets. I think I said these last week on the show, too, when we did our performances of the year, but I feel like I do need to preface this list with these here now as well. Reprise, a movie I have not seen. I've not seen Flight of the Red Balloon. I didn't get a chance to see Son of Rambo again, which is a movie I know, Scott, you weren't enamored with, but I loved absolutely when I saw it originally back at Sundance 07. And then I don't think it would probably appear here, despite being directed by Wong Kar-wai. I just haven't heard a lot of great things about My Blueberry Nights, but one I definitely wanted to see and still haven't had a chance to check it out yet. So those are my disclaimers here as we get into my list. And many people, having heard our review and our spoiler review in the first segment of the show, might be surprised, but my number five is The Dark Knight. I had a lot of strong contenders for this spot. Some of my honorable mentions easily could have been thrown into this spot, but I always think about how badly I want to see a movie again when I'm making this list. And even with its flaws or things I may not have enjoyed or would have liked Nolan to do differently, the bottom line is I cannot wait to see The Dark Knight again. For Ledger's performance, for most of the action scenes in the film, the IMAX shooting is breathtaking, and there is a lot to love about that movie. So for me, it is going to make the list at number five. What about you, Scott? Your number four.
My number four is Paranoid Park.
There's something that happened to me.
I thought so.
What I would do is, I'd write a letter. Save it, send it, burn it. It just feels good to have it all out.
One day, halfway through math class, there was an announcement.
What we have is a possible murder situation. Take a look at these pictures and you're gonna understand why we're here.
I had tried to put this part out of my mind, but the picture brought it all back.
This is Gus Van Sant's latest, and it's done very much in the dreamy, elliptical style that he's honed in recent movies like Jerry, Elephant, and Last Days. This movie has a little bit more narrative architecture than the other three, but I think it's equally seductive in the way it draws you into its world. In this case, the world of a lonely adolescent with a lot on his mind, or his conscience anyway. I haven't seen the film since Toronto of last year, so my memories of it are fairly hazy, but I almost feel like that's to the positive.
Yeah.
There's something about the movie that is very lush and textural, and I very much like this film.
Great pick. A movie we reviewed on the same show. We reviewed Funny Games, actually. Maddie, you're number four.
I always like this Tobias guy.
Uh-huh.
My number four, Paranoid Park. Really, it's just such a haunting little film, and that scene in the railway, I won't say anything more about it, just still lingers in my mind, you know, the same way it sort of dwells in the young protagonist's head throughout this film. This captures the surreality of surviving high school. I just saw American Teen last night. I think this captures the high school experience even more, and of course, a much more allegorical way.
Mm-hmm.
And it also works as a mystery, and thank goodness that it does. But I love that Van Sant makes that element work as well.
Okay. A good pick by you. My number four, we're going to have some overlap here, obviously, on this list. I'm going with Funny Games, the Michael Haneke film. And when I think about what I like to go to movies for, I mean, I love to be entertained, of course, like anyone else, but my most fulfilling experiences at the theater are the ones that challenge me. And I think Haneke certainly accomplished that with this film. It challenged my notions of violence, as you brought up, and our relationship to it, but also of masculinity, of what we expect from the cinema in general, and what I do and don't want to see, what I think is right and wrong. There are a lot of questions that he really challenges us. And the fact that so many people felt that he was condescending to audiences actually really disappointed me, because I think that condescending is when a filmmaker, you know, is manipulating you while trying to pretend like they're not. And Haneke's totally transparent about it. He's just putting it all out there in the open. It's a tough film to sit through. I'm not dying to see it again in this particular case, but one of the most provocative experiences I had at the theater all year, maybe of the past few years. So it's got to be here.
I think the fact of the matter is all that stuff, all those themes that you talked about, all those issues, they stem from the fact that it's a great story. He tells a suspenseful story.
He knows
story.
How to make a thriller.
Exactly. And that's what he did here. So you're exactly right. I'm a much more Aristotelian critic, sort of a new critic than you are. You're much, you know, filmic and sort of dwelling on themes.
Formalist,
if you will. But if you're not able to tell a great story, I'm not interested in meditations on anything else. And the fact of the matter is, he tells a compelling story, and that's why it succeeds.
I agree with you completely. We're going to get into our top three here in a moment, our favorite films of the year. But let's share some of the worst, the dregs of what we've seen so far this year. So, Scott, why don't you just rattle them off here? What would you consider right now the lowest of the low, the three worst films of the year?
The three worst films of the year, Prom Night, which is a sort of a remake, or that not really, of a Jamie Lee Curtis vehicle from 1980. And the reason why that would make my list of the worst is that there really is nothing going on in it at all. There's no atmosphere. There's
is
no
it
dialogue.
Just splatter?
It's not even splatter. Hmm. That's another thing about it. It's one of these PG-13 rated horror movies that are really squeaky clean, and there's no sense of danger. I finished watching the film and I said, why? What is the point of that?
Yeah.
There was nothing to engage you at all.
Hmm.
Another one would be In the Name of the King, a dungeon siege tale.
Maddie just watched this.
Man, you took one of my... I like this guy.
Yeah.
Which, you know, here's the way I kind of explain what this movie's all about. Basically, whenever a big blockbuster movie comes along, cut-rate toy stores fill up with cheap knockoff versions of the official merchandise. And, you know, for families who can't afford to splurge on Batman and Spider-Man stuff, it takes a lot of imagination for kids to see these crude lumps of plastic as their favorite movie characters. And basically, In the Name of the King is the crude lump of plastic version of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's everything that Lord of the Rings trilogy had, except much, much cheaper and much more poorly crafted.
But I have to say, the unintentional comedy in that film, Burt Reynolds as the made-up king, he looks like a Barbie doll. It's hilarious. Ray Liotta as the evil magician who gets to make out with Lele Sobieski. Choice.
Wow.
Just choice.
And I'm now sorry I missed
and
it.
And you haven't even mentioned Matthew Lillard.
Who's just drunk. I think he's just drunk. He has no idea where. I think he just wandered in on this set.
All right, you're number one.
My number one would probably be Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden?
Really?
This is the new film by Morgan Spurlock, yep, who did the popular Super Size Me a few years ago. And he comes from that Michael Moore school of first-person liberal filmmakers who adopt kind of a phony man-of-the-people pose to get their points across. Only Spurlock is much more dumbed down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I watched this movie. I think it was intended as sort of a easy-to-digest summary on the war on terror and how misguided it is. But really the point of it, from what I can tell, is he's saying, hey, not all people in the Middle East are terrorists looking to destroy
That's
America.
It.
And I think...
Don't we know that?
I thought we knew that. You know, I don't really hang out with people who don't know that.
Right.
So maybe there are people who need to know it, but are they going to see this movie? I don't
That's
think
a good
so.
Point. And actually, I will admit, I considered it for this list. It almost did crack the top three because sometimes I like to think about the worst of the year in terms of the biggest disappointments of the year. And I did have high hopes for that movie. I thought it was going to be an interesting meditation on that whole thing and the war and terrorism, and he doesn't get into it at all. He really doesn't at all. So, Maddie, you're number three.
Well, honestly, God, I thought there was going to be nothing that would beat The Other Boleyn Girl when I saw it, because it's really bad.
Yeah.
But I did find three. One of them was In the Name of the King, a dungeon siege tale. Jumper, awful.
Doug Liman.
Just excessive schlock. Hayden Christensen can jump around the world. My God, that is an awesome plot. It's just awful here. It's really terrible. And, of course, we talked about it, The Happening. I mean, we already spoke at this movie's funeral, so there's really nothing else to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can't add anything to it. For me, my number three, it was a three-way choice here. I had a tough decision between Speed Racer, Sex and the City, and Savage Grace. And I actually came down on the side of Savage Grace.
Wow.
Because I could sit through Speed Racer again, and I could maybe even sit through Sex and the City again, but I really do not want to see Savage Grace again for all of its lurid, it's just depressing and brutal and terrible.
You just don't get off on, you know, wallowing in sort of, you know, the sleaziness of the ruling class.
No,
I don't. That's kind of fun.
That movie was disturbing in just a bad way, not in a good bad way.
Not even Julianne Moore could redeem that movie for
me. No, not for me, not at all. So Savage Grace, my number three. My number two, It's the Wackness, a movie I think is overrated and actually just excessively trying to be cool and hip. It's just a glorification of cool, and I didn't think there was anything cool about it. And my number one, it is The Happening. I mean, come on, Scott, did you consider it? It's awful.
No, not at all. I didn't consider it. Oh. I'll tell you why.
Oh, please.
And this is the same reason that Speed Racer would not be among my worst.
Because Speed Racer is a good film.
Oh, well, no, I wouldn't go that far. But the thing about both films is that they do have a certain signature. I mean, you know, maybe you think it's a bad signature, but The Happening has a style to it that is not generic, that is not, you know, it's not Iron Man. I loved Iron Man. Iron Man was a fun movie. But if you were to tell me, you know, I don't know what a Jon Favreau movie looks like. I know
what a Shyamalan
film looks like. And I think that if you were to, say, turn the sound off and look at the way he crafts the images, or even better, if you put him in a time machine, bring this whole movie back to the 1950s, put James Mason in the lead, I think there's a good movie there.
Here's the only problem with your theory. You can tell an M. Night Shyamalan film if you're looking at his other films, but the style of this film is just awful.
I don't know if any of you guys have heard about this article in the New York Times. Well, apparently, honeybees are just disappearing all over the country. Tens of millions of them. All right, let's hear some theories about why this might be happening. Nobody?
The style is awful. It's just bad, schlocky filmmaking. I don't see it as a Shyamalan film at
all.
Not
even the first 15 minutes.
No. And I know a lot of people like the first 10 or 15 minutes. I actually was laughing from the opening 60 seconds. I thought it was hilarious.
Wow.
In terms of the way it was shot and edited, everything about it, I just thought it was terrible.
It's very awkward.
But I'm with you on the Favreau.
Yeah, no, there's there no doubt that it's generic, that he made a generic film. I don't think Favreau's ever going to get...
I made that same point, and we got 60,000 emails telling me how big an idiot I was.
Now I'm excited now.
All right, well, next segment we are going to get into some more of our favorite films of the year. So when we come back, we're going to wrap up those midterm evaluations. Our top three are next. Stay with us. Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. A movie we just mentioned here in the previous listener feedback segment, The Band's Visit. Maddie, you can finally see what all the fuss is about with that performance from Salah Bakri that I really enjoyed. That is out now. Also, Shine a Light, the Martin Scorsese documentary on the Rolling Stones, which we both liked but didn't love, I think it's fair to say. And then Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay, a movie I did not see. I don't think you did either. Did you, Manny?
It is number one on my Netflix saved queue.
Right now. It comes out with a single disc theatrical release version, but there's also an unrated 2-disc special edition. I'm sure that's the one Maddie is going to be checking out.
Of course. I don't even know why they bother. Why come out with a regular release when there's an unrated edition? I mean, what underage kids? What underage kids are you going to sell this to?
I don't know.
All right. Well, it's time now to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we truly are humbled by each and every single donation that we get, and it keeps us doing what we're doing. Thank you, thank you, thank you to our Silver Club donors, The Loop Corporation in Ealing, London. We are slowly taking over London.
Ealing,
we're
London.
We're huge in Ealing.
Yes, we are.
Of course, our
Lavender
review
Hill
of the
Mob.
Lavender Hill Mob probably helped. Neil from Oxfordshire, beautiful Oxford, England. Sam from Pinewood. Howard from beautiful Toronto, Ontario. Nathan from Earlsfield, London. And Tim in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. He's hoping, of course, that we come down and visit the Melbourne International Film Festival next year. And Jonathan Hennessy in Los Angeles. This is a donation made by Anne. And she just wanted to say, I wanted to give in the name of my fiancé, Jonathan Hennessy, in honor of our wedding on August 9th. When we started dating 2 years ago, I introduced Jonathan to Film Spotting, and we have been codependent junkies ever since. Thank you so much to both
of you. Yeah, great stuff from Annie, and thank you to Jonathan and everyone who donated. Remember that for every $10 you donate, your name goes into the Film Spotting hat at the end of the month, or whenever we get around to it, we pick a name out. You get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and just click on the donation tab at the top of the page. And I know we said that we were going to have After Hours this week. Of course, what I really meant to say is we're recording it this week. Look for it next week on Tuesday. We also encourage you to support the show by going to filmgaming.spout.com. Participate in our latest contest where we're asking you to recast the movie Reservoir Dogs. The grand prize winner is going to get a copy of the new graphic novel adaptation of M by John J. Muth. And the second prize winner is going to get a $10 gift certificate to the Spout store and a t-shirt. Some great stuff coming in so far. Definitely want to see some more entries. We're going to announce them on next week's show, so you have a week to get in there. Recast Reservoir Dogs at filmgaming.spout.com. And just like a knife down on my life, so many ways to set me right. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam, Maddie, and this week's guest here for this segment, Scott Tobias from the AV Club. And we're sharing our top three movies of the year so far. Let's dive right in. Scott, your number three.
My number three is 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which I'm considering a 2008 release because it was only released in LA for a week in 2007. And this is one of a growing number of really fine films from Romania, and it takes place in the waning days of communist Romania, where abortion was not legal, and follows two women as they attempt to procure an abortion. And this is just one of the most nerve-wracking movie-going experiences I had this year. And though it's not set in real time, it has that same kind of urgency to it. And I found myself, after the first 15 minutes or so, just really on the edge of my seat. It was it's a remarkable movie.
And you can get suspense out of those really long, drawn-out takes, absolutely. Some of the most suspenseful scenes you'll see in any movie.
Oh, that dinner scene.
The dinner scene, especially.
And what's being said at the dinner scene? Nothing. It's really just a banal, bourgeois conversation.
But that's exactly the point. You know what's going on inside that main character's head. And I mentioned Anna Maria Marinka last week on the show, that if we were including her as 08, and you absolutely could, we didn't review the movie until February here on Film Spotting when it opened in Chicago.
I actually had to ask you if I can include it on these lists, but because you included it on your top 10 for last year,
I
decided in solidarity.
I at least talked about it.
Otherwise, it would have been on my top 5.
Yeah, so we've never had any consistency to those rules about, you know, what films qualify as 07 or 08. That film, for me, if I was counting it as an 08 film, would have been somewhere on this list as well. So that's an absolutely great choice by you. Maddie, you're number 3.
Pardon, sorry for the interruption, but I'm selling this candy today to support my basketball team. If you ever lived in Chicago or New York, you've heard one of these kids on the subways approach you like that. And I've always wondered, what's the story behind these kids? Well, in Chop Shop, my number 3 film, director Rahim Bahrani imagines one of the lives in this marvelous little film about Ali, Alejandro, who lives in the Iron Triangle, the Willets Point section of Queens, just outside of Shea Stadium, which is basically, it's just a sea of scrap yards. It actually reminds me a lot of Tom McCarthy's movies. It's a character portrait, you know, sort of reminiscent of The Station Agent, The Visitor, only shot in a much more sort of pseudo-realistic style, much, much more gritty. And I thought it was mesmerizing, and I really encourage people to check it out. It's available on DVD.
Yeah, you've been telling me to see it, and I have not seen it yet, but you agree?
Oh, yeah.
It's a good one?
You have to see it. The thing that's remarkable about it is that it's an American film. It doesn't feel like an American film. It feels like an Italian neorealist film.
Wow. Well, my number 3 may come as a little bit of a surprise, I think, to you, Maddie, anyway, because it certainly hasn't come up a ton here on the show, and it was a surprise to me, but when I think back on the movies that really I want to keep watching and have now seen over and over again, it's got to make the list here at number 3. It's the documentary Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired.
He didn't perceive having intercourse with a 13-year-old girl is against the law.
The fact of Polanski leaving the country seems to have eclipsed what actually happened to the system of justice.
The judge was enjoying the publicity, and he didn't care about what happened to me, and he didn't care about what happened to Polanski.
Not much to tell you, except that I'm innocent.
A documentary that I saw at Sundance, talked with the director there at Sundance, Marina Zanovic, and, you know, I have seen it now like 7 or 8 times because it's been playing on HBO, and I never get tired of it. And I just think that 90% at least of what makes a good documentary is just having a great story to tell and not screwing it up. And this is a case, the Polanski one, where we all know enough about it to think that we know most of the story, and this documentary shows you that you really don't know anything about what happened at all. And by the end, there's this great sort of contradiction where it's impossible not to agree that fleeing for France was the absolute right thing for Polanski to do. But at the same time, the movie doesn't absolve him at all of his crime. And so she really pulls off an interesting trick there. And I do think Polanski, of course, is just an incredibly fascinating character. But the supporting characters here are so interesting to watch as well. The prosecutor, Roger Gunson, the judge, Lawrence Rittenband, ends up playing a huge role in this and really why you see that Polanski did what he did. So some great stuff in that documentary. And it's on my list, my number 3.
I love that one, too.
Okay.
But it's not. I have
not on the list.
Now I'm going to start parting ways with you guys.
Oh, no.
My number 2 is...
Here comes Errol Morris.
Here comes Errol Morris. Standard Operating Procedure is my number 2. And I'm really still flummoxed that I'm alone on this one. To me, his look at the infamous Abu Ghraib photos is the most important documentary to emerge from this war yet, including the more acclaimed No End in Sight. And it's an original Errol Morris investigation, you know, much like The Thin Blue Line, that first and foremost puts the lie to this idea that Abu Ghraib was the result of a few rotten apples. That may be an obvious point to some, but keep in mind that's the argument that won out in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us a fuller context into the creation of these pictures. And then beyond all that, the film is about the very nature of photography and what photographs tell us, what they don't tell us, and how they can lie or give us an incomplete story. I think it's a very rich film, and it's a difficult film to watch, but I think it's extremely underrated.
Well, maybe underrated by us here, obviously, because we did not have that strong reaction
to it.
We
missed the investigation. Well, I missed the investigation.
You wanted a little more.
I thought it became just rather sort of tedious because he just tells you exactly what happened behind each picture. I wanted some accountability. I wanted to go up the chain of command, or I wanted to go somewhere, and I never really got the context outside of what happened right outside those pictures for me.
But I think there's a discipline to it, though, to stay inside
there is.
The prison.
Yes. It was a
to
clear,
not go
conscious
without.
Choice
right.
that he was going for there. That's the documentary he's trying to make.
Works.
And I agree, though, that for me it got a little tedious as well. I felt like he actually just turned it into this exploration of the horrors of it, and it just became horror after horror. That narrative structure for me didn't work as well for me as it obviously did for you. I wish I had that reaction to it because I love Errol Morris and have loved many of his films. So a great pick, though. For me, a disappointment, but maybe one I need to see again. What about you, Maddie? Your number two?
Well, my number two is WALL-E. I have my problems once those robots get on the ark full of humans. I don't think the social commentary works all that well. But the fact of the matter is, in terms of pure storytelling, this film gets it exactly right. And to sound like the glorified Hallmark card that I am, it sort of reminds you why movies are magical, especially that beginning with WALL-E. Mm-hmm. I cannot believe how much I felt for that little chaplain.
Yeah.
It was amazing for me.
No, that is a great pick. My number two is another movie I saw on the festival circuit, caught it last September at Toronto, and that's My Winnipeg, the Guy Madden documentary, if you can call it that. And, you know, again, you talk about movies that are flawed. I mean, it spends a little too much time on the hockey scenes, sure, and probably too much time with the character on the train, but it's truly unique. Mm-hmm. I mean, like no other film I've seen this year, nor will I see this year, where it's blending fact and fiction and fantasy and yet somehow still producing something historical. It's a document of Winnipeg that I think Winnipeggers could be proud of. And obviously, being a Winnipegger, that's what he is going for there. We talked with Guy Madden about this at Toronto. And so I actually thought to come away from all that fantasy and still learn something interesting about the wonders of Winnipeg, it's an amazing feat.
But also there's the universality of it. You could apply it to any hometown.
Yeah.
It's an homage to your hometown, its uniqueness, and the way he brings it. It's just so wonderful, and it's funny. That's what it is.
It is very funny, and you make a great point, because whenever I have tried to convince people to go see it, what I tell them, the scene I tell them is, or the aspect of the film I tell them, is that the director hired actors to play his family, you know, and shot actual moments from his childhood to relive them and try to learn from them. I mean, what's more brilliant and funny and ironic and meta than that? I mean, I just love that whole concept, and the film is filled with great concepts like that. So my number two.
Yeah, well, it's a very liberated movie.
Yes.
Yeah. First and foremost, it's just, you feel like he can do anything.
Yeah.
But I should get to my number one.
You should.
No?
The moment is here.
Though I got to say, Maddie has completely stolen my thunder, because WALL-E is my number one film.
Hmm.
And everything that he's just said about WALL-E is something I was going to say. And the word that stands out for me is pure. It is just, that first third is just pure cinema. And for an animated film intended for a mass audience, WALL-E takes a great risk by going silent and allowing the images to speak for themselves. It also takes a risk by defying, at least for a while, that expected squeaky clean, very bright CGI look. I mean, Roger Deakins, the great cinematographer, was a technical advisor on this movie. I'm not as disappointed, I guess, as Maddie in where the film goes, and I think it is pretty bold for a movie of this kind to address issues of consumer culture, even if it maybe does it in a too heavy-handed way. And I almost feel like the last third kind of becomes Monsters, Inc. But with all of that said, that first third is just, I can't get over it. It's spectacular.
It is spectacular. That's a good word for it. Maddie, you're number one.
Well, it's In Bruges.
You'll never guess what, Ken. Ken, you'll never guess what?
What?
Got a date for tomorrow night.
I'm very happy for you.
With a girl.
Can you turn the light off, please?
I've only been in Bruges one day, got a date with a girl in the film business. The Belgian film business. They're doing a film better, Major.
The perfect film for me. Hitmen, history, patently offensive, pushing the envelope at every turn with its black humor, and of course, the big selling point for me, impeccably structured, owing, of course, to its writer and director, Martin McDonagh. And Colin Farrell is a revelation for me here. I just enjoyed spending so much time with that despicable character.
Yep, my favorite performances of the year, Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell, at least so far. So a great pick. I knew it was going to come up on your list there. My number one is a film that you guys have stolen my thunder, both of you. It made both of your lists, and it's a movie that I saw with you back in Toronto last September, Scott, Gus Van Zandt's Paranoid Park. But I did get a chance to see it again, and it was even better the second time when it played here in Chicago. And it's going to be really funny here, the connections between what we're saying here, because you brought up pure cinema. And I remember when we reviewed Paranoid Park, my buddy Sam Smith down in Nashville left a voicemail for us and said that he thought it was one of the best films he's seen in years. And he said that he thinks it reaches the level of pure cinema, where you've got, you know, no conventional narrative or storyline. It really relies on technique, on the camera angles, on montage, on sound in this soundscape to achieve this emotional experience out of it. And what's interesting is I read the book because I thought that we were maybe going to have the writer of the book, Blake Nelson, on the show. And it's a really fascinating book. And the movie is very close to the book, but maybe a good example of how it is pure cinema is, you remember the scene in the movie, and I'm not giving anything away, but the big moment happens. There's a big tragic event that happens. And the main character gets near a police car. And he actually, for a second, steps into the police car. And then he hesitates, and he steps out, and he flees the scene. And I remember watching it going, what are you doing? Like, why is he possibly getting into this police car where they may get some kind of DNA, you know, or something? I'm like, what is he doing? You read the book, you find out that he was reaching maybe for the radio, that he was going to reach in and grab the radio and maybe report what had just happened.
Right.
Well, I didn't see that in the film. Maybe I just missed it, but like Van Zandt doesn't show you reaching for anything. He just shows you getting, like he distances it in a way that he makes you sort of just have to fill in those blanks of why was he going to get in the car? He doesn't give you any of the inner monologue that the book gives you. It tells you why a character does something. The movie, he chooses to give you none of that. And that's what's so fascinating about it for me.
Well, I think I put myself in that character's shoes at that moment because I remember that moment.
Mm-hmm.
What would I do? And of course, the reason I put myself in his shoes is because of everything you said that Van Sant does so effectively through the use of sound. Almost, and there is almost a texture to this film that makes you feel like you're right there.
Yeah. Well, I obviously loved it. You guys were big fans of it as well. So a lot of Gus Van Sant love here on Film Spotting. Maybe not a big surprise. What about some honorable mentions? I know we've managed to all throw out a few other titles. Scott, did you have any that just missed your list you want to mention?
Yeah, I actually have two that I want to mention. Stuck and The Strangers, which are both two very nasty, low-down genre films. They have an edge to them that you don't really see that often. And
mm-hmm.
I think they're both very well executed in very different ways. Stuck being the Stuart Gordon film about this woman who runs over a homeless man and he's stuck in the windshield and she just leaves him in the garage to die. And The Strangers being a very simple home invasion story, much like Funny Games.
Which
but
is why I
the,
didn't want to see it.
but the skill level, you know, again, it's all about execution.
Sure.
And the skill level of The Strangers and the way he frames shots and the quiet of it is not expected and certainly not in keeping with what we're used to seeing from Hollywood horror films.
Again, not that our preconceptions can't be wrong. They often are. But I remember being surprised by your review of that film. Michael Phillips also surprisingly liked The Strangers. Many listeners wrote in and said, you really should see it and review it. But, of course, we're big scaredy cats. I don't want to be scared.
Exactly.
It's a movie. Funny Games was bad enough, so we didn't end up seeing The Strangers. Maybe I'll build up enough courage to see it. What about you, honorable mentions, Matt?
All right, well, these are my BCS ranking 6 through 10. Number 6, Forgetting Sarah Marshall. Number 7, Funny Games. 8, Dark Knight. 9, My Winnipeg. Number 10, Kung Fu Panda.
Kung Fu Panda. Okay, good pick there. My honorable mentions not in any order. I did mention Bigger, Stronger, Faster. I've got Iron Man on here, In Bruges, Forgetting Sarah Marshall, WALL-E, and the David Gordon Green film, Snow Angels. So it was a tough list. Like I said, it always is. But you know, when you're trying to pare these down and decide how to rank movies, it's very tough. But somehow we managed to get
through it. What are you talking about? We do this each and every week.
I know, and it drives me crazy. I agonize over it every week. And I'll also throw this little nugget out. A movie that absolutely would have bumped The Dark Knight probably out and been on this list, we haven't reviewed yet, so I'm not including it, but it would have made this list. So a little tease for an upcoming show here on Film Spotting.
All right, well, those are our top 5 movies of the year so far. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, The X-Files, I Want to Believe. Maddie, he doesn't want to believe, but I'm going to force him to see it anyway. And Step Brothers, which you did give a favorable review to, Maddie. So Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly in that one. In limited release, the documentary American Teen opens on a few screens. It's going to hit Chicago and a few other cities next Friday. We're going to review it on next week's show. And if we can fit in some thoughts on The X-Files, we certainly will. Our classic heist movies marathon is going to come back with Michael Caine in The Italian Job. And we are, of course, going to have another top 5 list. And maybe we go with top 5 swan songs, the suggestion that came in today from a listener and also from a listener a few weeks ago, tying in maybe with Heath Ledger a little bit, best final performances. That might be a good list to do.
All right. Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable production assistance and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Special thanks to Joe Dassault, Tori Malatia, and Steve Edwards, the whole gang over at Chicago Public Radio, and to Spoon and Merge Records for this week's music. Learn more at mergerecords.com.
Of course, we want to thank our first guest on the show, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. You can check him out online and at Ebert and Roper at the Movies for a while, and also Scott Tobias from the AV Club for his insights on his top 5 list. Scott, as always, great to have you on. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Check out Scott at avclub.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Matty Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
All right, we're all good?
One, two, three. How's that sound?
Yeah, it sounds good.
One, right. Two, three.
He sounds better.
What, that guy?
Yeah.
Oh. One, two,
Scott Tobias here from the AV Club. Check him out at avclub.com. Any other sites we should be pushing people to, Scott?
Oh, housenextdoor.com.
House Next Door, you write for that site as well?
No.
Okay.
I just like it.
ESPN.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. I was trying to plug you.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, it's all right. We'll do it again. I get all tongue-tied whenever I do the thank yous. It should be really easy. I should just be like, Scott, thank you for coming on. You're welcome. I had it. Whatever. It should all be.